Thanks for listening to CKUT and donate whenever you can.
CKUT, CKUT.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Mandla, your weekly news show with briefings and analysis from the continent of Africa, from a progressive Pan-Africanist point of view. And I'm Doug Miller, here with Gwen Schulman.
Except here, this time, is we are in Malawi, not in Montreal, and you're about to listen to a rebroadcast because Doug and I are away for Malawi, 1 month, actually. And in the time that we're there, we hope to do some great radio so that when we're back home in Montreal, there's going to be some good, fresh interviews for all of you to listen to. But in the meantime, we've picked some of our favorite shows from the last year to rebroadcast while we're away.
So stay tuned.
So tonight's show is a very special show. While, of course, we're rebroadcasting because Doug and I are currently in Malawi, what we're missing and we're sad to be missing is the fundraising show. It's always been a special time of year for us at Mandla. Why? Because we love CKUT and we love the fact that they create a space for us here on Mandla to do what we do. And we feel it's really important to support the station. So while we can't be there for an hour encouraging you to go online and make a donation, we're going to spend 2 minutes and encourage you to go online and make a donation. Why? Because CKUT has expenses. It has rent to pay. It has a wonderful skeleton, hardworking staff to pay. It has maintenance costs and equipment costs to pay. And it can only do that with the generosity of our listeners. So please consider going on to ckut.ca. There's a nice donate button right there. Please click on it and give what you can. Doug?
Well, and I want to thank CKUT and their staff and the student body of McGill University for their support of CKUT. I feel it privileged to be able to access the airwaves and spout off the way I do every week. So please be generous. Thank you very much and donate. Check out ckut.ca and click the donate button.
Gunfire in Guinea-Bissau's capital. The president says armed men attacked the presidential palace while he was inside.
I was in the middle of the Council of Ministers with all the members, including the Prime Minister, and we were attacked with very heavy weaponry for 5 hours. But now everything is under control. When I was elected president, I promised to fight two things, corruption and drug trafficking. And this is also linked to that.
Guinea-Bissau's become known as a transit point for cocaine between Latin America and Europe. It's also no stranger to political upheaval. There have been 9 coups or attempted coups since it gained independence from Portugal in 1974.
Guinea-Bissau has been a fragile state for decades because of narcotics trafficking and the manner in which it infiltrated state institutions, undermined them, I mean the military, the police, intelligence, political parties.
It's not immediately clear who's behind the failed coup. Some witnesses describe the gunmen as members of the military, others as civilians. Imbalo suggested many members of the security forces had died. The West African Regional Bloc, ECOWAS, and the UN Secretary General condemned what happened.
We are seeing a terrible multiplication of coups, and our strong appeal is for soldiers to go back to the barracks.
The president had called his cabinet together ahead of an ECOWAS meeting on Thursday to discuss a string of successful military takeovers in the region over the past 18 months. Some fear the violence in Bissau is part of a wave of copycat coups.
One of the differences between the situation with him and Burkina Faso, for instance, or even Mali, the coup in Mali, is that he's a former general, so he he has obviously kept strong ties within the armed forces.
Some called Mbalo's rise to power following the 2020 election a coup, after he claimed victory despite opposition allegations of fraud. There have been reports of tension within his government, and in recent days he'd reshuffled his cabinet. Mbalo's described the latest violence as an attack on democracy and says some of those involved have been arrested. Alexia O'Brien, Al Jazeera.
Welcome to Amandla Radio this week here at CQUT 90.3. I'm Doug Miller here in virtual Zoom reality with Gwen Shulman. And we have news and analysis for you on the continent of Africa. And this week, there's been plenty happening. I'm going to go on the light side, and I'll talk about the Africa Cup. I call it light, but I've got some heavy stuff to deal with. In the meantime, what you just heard was a clip from Al Jazeera talking about an attempted coup in Guinea-Bissau with a fairly good explanation of what was all about and what's going on. And Gwen, that really dovetailed nicely into what you had already planned with Amit Lowe about the previous week's coup in Burkina Faso.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so a sad dovetail for sure. And as you will hear shortly, the interview that I conducted with Amit Lowe of the Group for Research and Initiative for the Liberation of Africa, while we were focused on Burkina Faso, he provided a very good and good analysis of the destabilization of the entire West African region. So the fact that Guinea-Bissau is now, potentially the next one to fall under this wave of coups. We've seen Mali, we've seen Guinea, Burkina Faso, most recently, the attempt in Guinea-Bissau. It's part of a regional dynamic. I'm not going to explain it. Amit Lowe is. He does a wonderful job. I encourage you to take a listen. The president of Burkina Faso, Roch Kabore, was overthrown in a coup a week and a half ago. Roch Kabore was elected to power in 2015 and then again in 2020. He came to power on a wave of popular protest against Blaise Compaoré, who had ruled the country with an iron fist for 37 years. Brought to power in a bloody coup that saw the assassination of the country's beloved revolutionary leader, Thomas Sankara. As for Kabore, it's been a rocky road, dealing with efforts from close and far to destabilize his government, a fractious army, widespread poverty, hunger, and frustration at the lack of progress Burkinabes have seen since he won power. Well, now he's out of power and the army is back in. Coup leader, Lieutenant Colonel Paul-Henri Sandaogo Damiba, has dissolved the government and parliament and suspended the constitution. To help us understand the whys, hows, and what's next, we're joined by Amit Lowe, a frequent guest and friend here on Amandla, and a member of the Group for Research and Initiative for the Liberation of Africa in Toronto, Canada. Amit, welcome back to Amandla.
Thank you, Gwen, for having me today. Thank you.
So let's start with, what do we know about why Kabore was overthrown?
As you kind of stated out in your, introduction, it's a it's a set of different factors, a combination of factors that are different. And you mentioned that he came to power in 2015 after the overthrow of the former dictatorship of Blaise Compaoré in 2015 and got just re-elected a year or so ago. So the thing is that they haven't been really a big change in people's life after he came to power in 2015. Not only that, but you have the security question in Burkina Faso, which is going beyond Burkina Faso, which is called right now the Sahel insecurity, with the so-called jihadist movement that are spread across the region and that are creating a very big crisis in the whole region, including Burkina Faso, Mali, Niger, and beyond. So right now you have a situation in the country where, even though you have a democratically elected government, most of the country is not, the northern part, the certain part of the country are not under the control of the government because of this insurgency situation. schools have been closed. We have millions of people that have been displaced. And the fact that he did not manage to get the security question under control, in my sense, have kind of created a situation very bad that people are becoming less and less patient in regard to his governance. On top of that, you have the classical issues of political governance of the countries, the issues of corruption happening. And on top, if you add the consequences of the pandemic that took place a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, you have massive poverty in the country. But this is not specific to Burkina Faso. That's why we have to look at the situation in Burkina Faso as part of a dynamic that's happening across the region, whether it is in Mali, in Guinea, and even today there was this attempt of military coup in Guinea-Bissau.
To bring our listeners into the loop, so let's look at the regional perspective, because for those of our listeners who are unaware, in the last 18 months, there was a coup d'etat in Guinea and another one in Mali. So there's a whole regional dynamic going on to this whole thing. And now the latest is Burkina Faso. So why don't we shift to that a little bit? Can you talk, sort of draw a portrait for us of what's going on in the region? You're talking about insurgencies and so-called jihadist movements. A lot of people are having a hard time following what's going on in West Africa. I know it's complicated, but can you kind of try to flesh that out for us a little bit?
Yeah, I think that the region has been going through one of its most severe crises for the last 50 or 60 years. And is a crisis with multidimensional. There is a crisis of governance, political governance of the countries, the way these countries are run politically. There's an issue of a geopolitical reordering of the world that is taking place also in that region. And you have all this competition between different international forces. Mostly you have actors like France and the United States who have been in the region for some time, but who've been starting to be challenged by new actors like Russia or China. And all this in the process of trying to get access to the resources of the region. So if you put on that into perspective, and that you have the disaster and the impact of climate change happening in the region, because it's a very dry region with the Sahara Desert, we have a people population that have been relying on agriculture, that are no longer in a situation to live by the product of their labor, and then trying to move around. If you don't have, in this kind of context, a strong presence of a state providing basic services to the population, you make the population very vulnerable and then easily co-opted by those so-called movements that are supposedly calling for jihadist movement and trying to supplement what the state have not been able to provide. Because of that, if you look at the situation in Mali, you have the French who have been there since 2013, supposedly trying to fight these movements, but there have been no progress. And for me, the reason why there's no progress is that because there's a double game happening. One way where they are talking about fighting this movement, but on another time, they also are in collusion with these forces, because they use that as a justification for their presence, so that when they stay in the country, they can negotiate economic deals with the government and then allow their multinational to come and cooperate and then be active in those countries in terms of resource extraction, mostly in mining and gold, like gold. Mm-hmm. If you look at the situation in Mali, for example, in Niger, most of the uranium that's being used in France, for example, to fuel the nuclear industry is coming from Niger, almost 60 to 70%. And because Mali and Niger are borders, have a common border, and they suspect that there's a lot of uranium in northern Mali, they have been trying to create an enclave in northern Mali to have a buffer zone between Mali and Algeria, a zone that will be captured by the French so that they can be having access to the resources in that region. And because of that, in my sense, they have been complicit with this insurgent movement and not being creating the condition to fight them effectively. And also, worse, they're preventing the government of Mali to have access to that region, which is something that nobody can comprehend, because this poses a question of sovereignty.
So you're saying that the French army is active, playing a role in actively blocking Mali from access to some of its own territory?
Absolutely, absolutely. And this is a sovereignty question, because when this military coup happened in recently in Mali, they said that this situation can no longer continue, and they try to diversify their partnership, trying to bring in other forces that couldn't collaborate with them, frankly, so that they can combat the situation, because they do not have control of almost 2/3 of the territory that are under the control of these movements. The same thing happened also in Burkina Faso, and Niger also is unstable. So you have these conditions that are really common to the whole region, and unless there is a strong pooling the resources together between those states and then attacking this issue frontally, it will be very difficult for myself to bring a situation. And so the cool military coup that are happening right now is rather a consequence of the situation, a symptom of a problem that is deeper, mm-hmm. which is, as I say, a problem of governance in one sense, a problem of geopolitical infighting between international forces trying to have access to the resources in the continent. Mm-hmm. And all those two elements are aggravated by the eco-social and economic crisis that have been accelerated by the pandemic situation that people have been living through for the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. So let's get back to the specifics a little bit of the coup in Burkina Faso. So the coup leader, current Lieutenant Colonel Damiba, dates back to the Compaoré. In fact, dates back to the when Compaoré came to power, the assassination of Thomas Sankara. Is there any indication that Compaoré is involved in this coup at all, or does he have a hand in it?
I wouldn't exclude it, even though there's no enough evidence for that for the moment. But what is sure is that the new president who took over, the new military leader, was part of a special forces within the army that was really the presidential guard of President Compaoré. And that unit, which was one of the mostly well-equipped section in the army, was led by the general that was called Djendere. And Djendere was the one who was behind the assassination of Thomas Sankara. Now, at the time when he was those events were happening, I'm not sure how involved the current military leader was. Maybe he was just a rank and file officer or something like that, but because it was 55 to 10 years ago. But I wouldn't remove that completely, but time will tell. Mm-hmm. Right now, what they did initially when they took over power 2 weeks ago, they suspended the constitution, and everybody was nervous to see what's going to happen to the trial of that is happening right now in trying to identify who are behind the assassination.
Yes,
of
well, let's okay. So let's talk about that for our listeners who are not aware. There is something very important going on in Burkina Faso in terms of these decades-long efforts to end the impunity around the assassination of Thomas Sankara, and it has finally culminated in a trial going on right now in Burkina Faso. Can you briefly describe what that trial is about and what you think the implications of this coup, if any, are for the trial proceedings?
Yes, the trial is to try to identify, finally, after 25 years of struggle, who were behind the assassination of the former president of Burkina Faso, Thomas Sankara, and 12 of his comrades in 1987. After he was killed, Blaise Compaoré became the president. And for 15 years or so, for until 2015, he was the president of the country. He was removed by this popular uprisings in 2015, and he ran away, and now have been exfiltrated by the French forces, military forces, to cross over the border, and now he's living in Ivory Coast. So for all this time he was in power, people are suspecting that he was in collusion with all this jihadist movement that I was talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. And because of that, they kind of he was behind them, and then provided them with access to the territory of Burkina Faso, sometimes with a diplomatic passport to help them travel around. Because of that, Burkina Faso have never witnessed a lot of issue from a security perspective. But now, since he's gone, we have seen this situation developing very fastly, and people are trying to analyze and see that if there is any connection between Blaise Compaoré, who was removed from power, and all these jihadist movements. So coming back to the trial itself, when the military coup took place, they suspended the constitution, but there have been a lot of reaction, including from the International Campaign Justice for Thomas Sankara and other movement, insisting that the trial have to continue, because this is a trial that people have been waiting for 25 years, and it's just this year that it has been started. And we are at the end of this process, because we are just at the process where we are listening to the testimonial of the people. But from what I heard yesterday or today, looks like the constitution has been restored, and then the trial is supposed to resume tomorrow. So we keep looking forward to it. And then the new leader in place in Burkina Faso will be judged based on how things will evolve at the practical level. So we cannot give him a presumption of good faith, and then we'll see what's going to happen. But what is important for us is that there is no reason that this process will not go to a final conclusion, so that finally, after 25 years, the families of people who have been murdered by the Compaoré regime in 1987 at least know who were behind it, and then so can at least have a peace of mind of what happened. That's very important for the families. That's one very important for the Africans also, because it will put an end to a cycle of impunity. And then maybe, hopefully, we'll give an example for the future that you cannot continue to do whatever you want to do and then assassinate people without any consequences. Mm-hmm. So that's a good example that we have to follow very closely.
Are you worried, though, that given the current instability and the fact that there recently has been a coup, that it's going to be difficult for this process to see through? Or, I mean, I know I'm asking, this is conjecture, but it's not an ideal context in which to be holding this trial that everybody has fought and worked so hard to achieve.
Yeah, of course, we're very nervous, and then we're very anxious also, because this trial is a culmination of 25 years of effort to get to this point, and it will be very, very, very unfortunate if it had to be stopped or not going to this final conclusion. So right now, everything seems to be going back to normal starting tomorrow. The trial is supposed to be to resume starting tomorrow, so we will see what's going to happen, and then we'll take it from there. But hopefully, we're crossing our fingers that the process will resume, because it's something very critical, very fundamental, to have justice done for Thomas Sankara and all these comrades who have been murdered in 1987. Not because of just the person, but because of what they represented, and also the political project that they're trying to implement at the time, trying to put a break to the new colonial path of the countries that have been costing them their lives. So at this context, in this specific context in Africa today, or in the region where you have all this frustration resulting from this crisis I've been mentioning, the socioeconomic crisis, the crisis of governance, the crisis of imperialism trying to accelerate the process of resource extraction, and I think it's important that the model that has been represented by the Sankarist movement be shown at the youth, and also as an alternative of what can be done when the population have a good leadership in terms of political vision, and also is capable of rallying the masses of the population together in a collective effort to improve the condition of the people.
So maybe one last question, just getting back now to the current political situation in the country. I know that ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, the African Union, the United Nations, these regional bodies and international bodies are taking some steps to address what's going on in Burkina Faso. Do you think that they have any effective role to play? And if so, what would that be exactly?
They should, especially the regional body, ECOWAS, should have been. But unfortunately, what happened is that there have been, in the recent years, a kind of disconnect between ECOWAS and the African Union as institution and the aspiration of the general populations. And more and more, it has become like a very bureaucratic organization, and then not being able to have an impact on what's happening in the region, whether in the involvement, in the lack of active involvement in terms of fighting these insurgent movements happening in the region, or also being silent sometimes when you have this disruption of government happening in some countries. They've been very vocal when there are some military coups happening in Mali or Burkina Faso, but you have different type of coup. Sometimes you have institutional coup that are resulting from people who are already in power, who've been democratically elected, and who through manipulation of the constitution or the judicial system managed to stay in power. And the ECOWAS have never raised their voice against those practices. Now, once the situation gets so bad, as it happened in Guinea, sometime you create a situation where the military have the opportunity to jump in and then intervene. And at the time, they start making all these big announcements and then these sanctions, which most of the time are not very effective. Because if you look at the sanctions that have been imposed in Mali right now, it's very unfair because it's a big embargo in the country. All the financial resources of the country have been frozen internationally. But the victim of the situation will be just the general population, rather than those who are in power who are leading the countries. So I think that it is an opportunity today for ECOWAS or the African Union to redirect the action, become more, go back to the original path of becoming a people-oriented organization, rather than being just what they call a union of heads of states who every now and then convene some international meetings and then put some sanctions or make some declaration or press releases. So it is very important for them to go back to the original mission of being people organization, being active, because they have a standby force that have been used in the past in Liberia, if you remember, in the early around the 2000, when there was this rebellion in Liberia and Sierra Leone. ECOMOC has managed to play a very important role in restoring peace in those countries. But we have seen none of those happening in the region right now, whether it is in Burkina Faso or Mali or Niger. And that should be one of the main mission right now, to restore peace and also to have a strong stand, not only against military coup, but also those kind of civilian coup, which is come to the same result because it's a process of interruption of the political governance of the country. So it's very important.
Okay, Ahmet. Well, it's a pretty bleak picture that we're drawing here, but I guess maybe one of the positive things we can pull out of it is that miraculously, and again, through the hard work of so many people, this trial is going forward in Burkina Faso and serves as an inspiration for a lot of people. So, you know, that those ideals of Thomas Sankara survive on, and, you know, they're right there below the surface, I guess.
Yes, and the good thing is that, as I mentioned, there's this disconnect between the institution and the people. And in the region in general, you have seen an awakening in the political consciousness of the younger generation of Africans. Mm-hmm. And there's a massive, if you heard, there was this convoy of military forces from France who are trying to move from Ivory Coast to go to Niger. And wherever they try to travel through in Burkina Faso and different countries in Niger, they get blockaded, so they were not able. And you have all this youth movement happening right now, that are being very vocal, and then also to raising some fundamental question, the question of sovereignty, the question of the presence of this international military forces, the denouncing the militarization of the conflict, and then also they are denouncing the way these institutions are sometimes complicit with some state governors that are in place or with some, you know, some other institutions. So it's important to notice also that the people are not just staying and they're not doing nothing. There's more and more mobilization from the civil society organizations who are trying to make a different point of view put on the table to push the leadership of these countries and of this institution to bring back the foundation of the mission on the table. So it's, for me, it's very promising to see that when this is happening, that you have also at the same time an awakening in terms of political consciousness of the younger generation of people. And then those are represent 60 to 70% of the population today in Africa. So the future is in their hands.
Perfect place to end. Thank you so much, Amet. I really appreciate you for joining us again here on Amandla and for your insights and analysis. We'll keep an eye on the situation.
Thank you so much, Square.
Take
Thank
care.
You. Okay, bye.
You say you love your country.
You love your country.
You say you must fight for justice.
Fight for justice.
You say you must defend democracy.
Defend democracy.
You won't stop to fight for justice and human rights. You ready to sacrifice everything plus your life. Say if you die, you make them better for those who survive. Let me warn you.
Let me warn you.
Before you start your journey.
Before you start your journey.
To fight for freedom.
Fight for freedom.
Democracy and justice.
Democracy and justice.
But let me warn you.
Let me warn you.
Before you start your journey.
Before you start your journey.
Fight for the people.
Fight for the people.
People love your country.
People love your country.
The people, yeah.
Let me warn you.
Them to be fear.
Let me warn you.
Them no ready.
Let me warn you.
Them no ready to die.
Let me warn you.
Them they look for hope.
Let me warn you.
And where them go push.
Let me warn you.
Where them go push go.
Let me warn you.
Where them go push go for front.
Let me warn you.
And I'm go hail you.
Hail you.
Praise you.
Praise you,
praise you,
hail you,
hail you, go
hail you,
hail you,
praise you,
praise you,
praise you,
praise you, push you go front. Then when police come,
never run leave you.
When soldier come,
never run leave you.
When bullets start to fly,
never run leave you.
And people start to die,
never run leave you.
Then go run to the town,
never run leave you.
When the fight start to hot,
never run leave you.
Your people know.
Never run, leave you.
Your people go.
Never run, leave you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Never run, leave you.
Revolution for Nigeria. Revolution for Togo. Revolution for Benin. Revolution for Ghana. Revolution for Burkina Faso. Revolution for Mali. Revolution for Cote d'Ivoire. Revolution for Zimbabwe. Revolution for Somalia. Revolution for Cameroon. Revolution for Congo. Revolution for Kenya. Revolution for Zimbabwe. Now one more show.
As you all know, I have a strong Malawi connection, so I was following the Africa Cup with great energy and enthusiasm because Malawi made the cup probably for the first time in about 20 years or more.
Yay!
Not 20, no, I remember it was about 2010 they played Algeria and beat them on the first game of the cup. And Malawi got through the group phase with very good standing. They lost to Guinea, a very strong side that they lost to, and then astoundingly beat Zimbabwe. Their regional competitor has always beaten us in 30 meets, perhaps once before we've beaten them, and drew with Senegal, the big powerhouse on the West Coast. So it was a wonderful third place finish for them, and it got them through to the round of 16, sudden death, where they came face to face with Morocco. Absolutely, 1 week ago, last week, they played, and they played before we had put this show on air, so we didn't have the results. And I regret to tell you, they lost 2-1 to Morocco. Mm. So that's it. I'm not going to impose Malawi on you anymore, except to say the side played very, very well against some very, very strong teams and a very presentable showing. And it was a story of underdogs, this one. Mm-hmm. The Gambia coming through right to the semifinals. Quarterfinals, Comoros coming through to the quarterfinals. It was really quite spectacular. And so smaller countries with smaller teams, it's a sort of Iceland factor in the Euro. And so it was just as the commentator last week pointed out, different regions of Africa have been exposed to soccer in different ways over long periods of time. And so East and Southern Africa are the least developed systems as of now, while West Africa and North Africa dominate. And that's exactly what we see now in the quarterfinals with Cameroon and Gambia, Burkina Faso and Tunisia, Egypt and Morocco, Senegal and Equatorial Guinea. Nobody from the East, nobody from the South, all from the West and the North. Today, playing in the semifinals is Burkina Faso against Senegal, and tomorrow will be Cameroon against Egypt. So there we are. In fact, what's interesting is the North African powerhouses, Tunisia, Morocco, Egypt, only Egypt is left. And Burkina Faso has played the spoiler a bit in this one. And Cameroon, the home team, of course, has a lot on the line and a long history in the cup. So we're keen to see how this comes out. The finals will be played on Saturday and Sunday. I have to apologize to listeners because last week I neglected to cover a very important item because I was so caught up in other things. But there was an unfortunate incident at the Africa Cup when Cameroon was playing Comoros. A large crowd of people, way too many people, had been given tickets to get the last few seats. The stadium had been under, well, they'll explain it in the clip that you're about to hear. So here's a report from Al Jazeera about the very regrettable deaths, and it's not Al Jazeera, it's South African Broadcasting Corporations, and it's Patrick Motsepe, who is the president of the Confederation of African Football, the first non-West African president of the CAF, and he's explaining the dilemmas and the problems and what they plan to do. Meanwhile, the real problem is that in Cameroon, we have a one-party effective state under one man, dictator for some 40 plus years, and who as like all his ministers blamed the people for the problem rather than accepting culpability for military style management, top-down management, not looking for the ways to deal with how to help people. So stay tuned.
Clearly there were deficiencies. Clearly there were failures. There were weaknesses. There were things you can't. There are things that we should have that should have been foreseen, man. Come on. You take preventative measures. You take steps that anticipate that if certain things happen, those interventions will ameliorate or preferably bring to an end circumstances that can give rise to injuries, let alone loss of life.
Motsepe was not mincing his words when he addressed the media about the unfortunate incident. He wants an investigation into the circumstances that led to the stampede.
The first entry, you've got to show your ticket. It's good. You are far away from the stadium. You've got to show your ticket. Once you've done that, and then you've got to move on and show your COVID, the COVID-19 documentation, which is quite some distance away from the entry. But the processes are fine. And then came the problem. This gate, which was supposed to be open, if that gate was open, we wouldn't have this problem. But somebody closed it. Who closed it? On whose instructions? And when they realized that it was closed, why wasn't it opened immediately? So we'll deal with those issues.
The stampede happened as crowds struggled to gain access to the stadium to watch the host nation play the Comoros in the last 16 knockout match. There could be more casualties, as a hospital in the area reported at least 38 people had been injured in the stampede.
Even in the best stadiums, there are accidents and problems do happen. But we have to make sure that at all times, the infrastructure and the resources are world-class. Was it a risk coming here? I'm happy and pleased with the measures that are in place. I'm extremely disappointed and sad and hurt with what has happened yesterday. And everything possible is going to be done to make sure that doesn't happen again.
The Olympic Stadium has a capacity of 60,000, but it was not meant to be more than 80% full due to COVID-19 restrictions. Officials said about 50,000 people had tried to attend the match.
You could even have had 100% attendance, I mean, assuming that there was no COVID-19. It's the measures you put in place to control people and control entry. And those measures were there, but we need... and the appropriate preventative steps were put in place, but the question is, why were they not functional as they were supposed to?
Due to low turnout at other matches, it is reported that Cameroon authorities have organized mass transport and given out free tickets to lure fans. Mduduzi Ndlovu for SABC News.
There's been a lot of criticism in Europe and the press, and I'm from the teams and managers and fans for the Cup, Africa Cup, being played at this time of year, and it's really regrettable that it should be like that. Africa is taking on a very important role in world soccer nowadays, and I found a lovely defense of the Cup against these criticism by an independent broadcaster named Fiago, very passionate footballer and a European who denounces his own fellow country Europeans, if that's what you would call them, for their narrow-mindedness. And so here's a small little rant from Fiago about how important Africa soccer is and African players are to world soccer.
The Africa Cup of Nations, short AFCON, is starting these days, a massive trophy to win with world-class stars. But still, we're seeing a huge wave of backlash and anger coming from the major European clubs and their fans about the fact that Africa's continental football competition is happening. Why is that? Is it any justified, and what can be done about it? My name is Fiago and I got you covered. First things first, let's get an overview of the competition. What is the AFCON? Since 1957, the Africa Cup of Nations, short AFCON, has been Africa's continental football football competition. For Europe, it's the Euro. For South America, it's Copa America. And for Africa, it's the AFCON. The tournament is played every 2 years, every odd year to be precise, and 24 national teams compete in it. There are 6 groups of 4, with the 2 best teams per group advancing, plus the 4 best third place teams. Then the knockout stage begins with a round of 16, so we have the exact same format here as the Euro. Algeria are the current holders, as Riyad Mahrez and his fellow countrymen lifted the trophy in 2019. And the 2022 edition does indeed look very exciting. It is both highly competitive and stacked with quality. For example, the Copa America 2021 had 10 participating teams from South America with a combined market value of 2.468 billion euros. And the top 10 nations in this year's AFCON have a combined market value of 1.955 billion euros. That is of course a little bit less, but let's be honest, you expected the difference to be way, way higher, didn't you? I mean, on the one hand, we're talking about footballing giants like Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay and co, multiple World Cup winners, and on the other hand, we're talking about African nations that are still very, very underappreciated in football. The difference to be so tiny is very remarkable. And it's also super close and unpredictable who's gonna win. Algeria are the current favorites and title holders, but you can see they're only the 5th most valuable team in the tournament, below Senegal, Ivory Coast, Nigeria and Morocco. And there is a total of 9 national teams with a squad market value above 100 million euros. The AFCON this year will have 60 players with a market value of 10 million euros or more, 33 of them have a market value of 20 million euros or more, and 16 players are worth 30 million euros plus. There will be 55 players from Ligue 1, 31 from the Premier League, 22 lads earning their money in the Serie A, and at least 11 in the Bundesliga and 10 in Spain in La Liga. So as you see, there will be so many widely known stars from the top 5 European league in this year's tournament. 128 total players, very impressive if you ask me, but quite ironically, that is also the main reason why exactly the competition is so disrespected in Europe. Because in 128 cases now, a European top 5 league team is going to miss an important player for the club for a whole month maybe. So as you can imagine, many of those clubs and especially their fans are going mad right now. You can go through certain social media platform football communities and you will see tons of people even demanding the AFCON to be cancelled. And it doesn't only come from the fans, as even journalists are now hopping on the train. For example, Ajax's Sebastian Haller was literally being asked if he would not rather stay in the Netherlands and play for Ajax and ditch this Africa Cup. And he rightfully replied, "This statement shows the disrespect for Africa. Would this have ever been presented to a European player towards a European championship? Of course I will go to the Africa Cup to represent Ivory Coast. That is the highest honor." And that is absolutely understandable. But why is the football world even questioning players' decisions of representing their national teams at their continental competition? Well, quite clearly, the number one argument why European fans are getting upset about this is because people say it shouldn't be played in the middle of the European league season. And most of these guys say stuff like, "Yo, the Euros are played in summer, Copa America, every international competition, so you guys over in Africa are supposed to do the same. Stop disturbing our holy European leagues. You are supposed to play in June and July." And at first glance, this point might seem reasonable, but if you look a little bit deeper into things, you will soon realize that it is nothing but sheer ignorance. Disclaimer, as a proud European myself, I might be starting a little rant now about the behavior of my fellow European continent man. Point number one, the weather. June and July in Africa is not like June and July in Europe. In North Africa, for example, it's way too hot to play in June and July. Same thing goes for Qatar, hence they're moving the World Cup to December. While in the western part of Africa, in June and July, you often have crazy apocalyptic rainfalls, making it pretty much impossible to play such a football tournament there. That, by the way, also goes for the Cameroon, the host of this year's edition. So if you really follow the European demands there to host the tournament in June and July every single time, that would mean only South Africa and maybe one or two other nations would be suitable to host such a tournament, and that just can't be it. Point number two is different league schedules. Here in Europe, we know league seasons ranging from August to May, but it's not everywhere like that. There is actually leagues starting in different months and ending in different months. Yes, imagine, that actually exists, and they have their title race finishes in other periods of the year, so you can't generalize. I think it's seriously disgraceful how many of my fellow Europeans expect everyone to adapt to our preferences. Why? It's literally the Africa Cup of Nations. They decide when it's best to play, and they play when it's most suitable for them in Africa. Yes, I understand your anger to a certain extent, because there are many players from our leagues, but it's still none of our business. It's their continental competition, and they deserve to play that. And here's why the AFCON deserves way more respect than it's currently getting. Number one, as harsh as it may sound for some of you, but for most players, it's still the case country over club. You know, of course there's always exceptions, but most players are going to play for a handful or even more clubs throughout their career and change clubs every few years. The one constant in their career is going to be their national team. They will always play and fight for their country. During the AFCON 2019, for example, Sadio Mane said that he would happily trade in his Champions League title with Liverpool, that he had just recently won a few weeks ago, for an Africa Cup with his nation Senegal. And you keep hearing similar things from different players, also non-African. For example, Messi and Ronaldo. How happy would they be to trade in their Champions League titles for a World Cup with their country? Even the Ballon d'Ors. You could also see that when they won the Euros or Copa America respectively, that meant so much to them, way more than a European League title or even Champions League title can ever mean to them. And for African players, I think this factor is even bigger, as most of them live far away from home in Europe. Pretty much all of them still have some family members and also many friends in their home country, and these guys are often national heroes and the biggest hope of the country, so imagine what kind of motivation it will be to make them proud. And point number two is the fact that for African players, the AFCON is the biggest title they can win with their national team. I mean, realistically speaking, it's still sadly nearly impossible for African nations to win the World Cup. I really hope that will change within the next decades maybe, but for now, due to inequality in development and money, this is the only ever chance for African players to achieve big glory with their national team, the AFCON. And then we have people who seriously want to take that from them because it might cost their team 2 points in the league. We have Harry from Merseyside who's crying on Twitter demanding the AFCON to be cancelled because it might destroy his team's title charges. Well, guess what, Harry? F*** off. Your club knew exactly what they were doing when they were signing these African players. It's not like Mo Salah was going to convert to Italy anytime soon or Sadio Mane to Austria. If you don't want African players to represent the national teams, then stop signing them. I need to calm down. This stuff makes me angry. Let's stay rational and get to some proper solutions to the problem. I believe there's a few things that just need to happen in order to get the AFCON the respect it deserves, and one of them has to come from the African Football Confederation themselves. Do yourselves a favor and play the tournament every 4 years, not every two. This has several upsides. On the one hand, it would give the tournament way more prestige. Look at the Copa America, who started to play the tournament every 1 or 2 years due to some special editions. The value of the competition was just washed down the drain. It was not what it used to be. Luckily, they're changing back now to 4 years as well, so take that as an example and play the Africa Cup every 4 years. It will hold a lot more value and after all maybe even bring in the same or even more TV revenue with one tournament that you would usually get with two tournaments. And also the negative side effects for the European leagues would not come about so often, so they would maybe stop crying so much. And number two is a proper winter break in the European leagues. Yes, you heard right. Many European leagues already have that. In the last years it was a bit shorter because of the pandemic and all that stuff, but usually, for example, the Bundesliga, they have a winter break of almost 1 month. Why not make that a general thing in Europe? I mean, the whole European leagues can always stop when there's international qualifiers, so why not give a winter break that covers, let's say, at least the group stages of the AFCON to reduce the number of league games missed by these African players to a minimum, especially with a rising number of African players in these European top 5 leagues. That should be a thing. And it would also help the other non-African players in the league to recover from injuries and calm down for a few weeks to prepare for those crazy upcoming months of fixture congestion. Would that really be so hard to implement, especially if the AFCON was only held every 4 years? Absolutely not. I really believe we need just three things. Number one, a slightly less cocky attitude from my fellow Europeans towards this African tournament. Number two, the realization from the Confederation of African Football that every 4 years might make more sense than every 2 years. And number three, that said winter break given by European leagues for at least a part of the AFCON. And if that happens, then I think the AFCON can fit into the European football schedule very well and become a major football tournament that billions of football fans around the world look forward to. Even though the Africa Cup is not quite on the level of the Copa America or the Euro yet, it might as well be in the future. Especially if the development at African football continues to grow at a rapid rate just like it has been over the last two decades. And already now, it deserves to be treated with the same respect. It is a big tournament. So, that was my little explanation, rant, real talk about the AFCON, however you might want to call it, but I can just say I am super hyped for the Africa Cup to start now, and I want to know from you, who do you think will win the AFCON 2022? There's quite a few contenders who can all win it, so let me know in the comments, and I guess I'm going to be watching some African football now. Fiago's out. Peace.
Fathers, we came to win, we accept no defeat.
We are young, we are strong, we are champions. We're gonna rise up above the sea. Africa, unite.
Ola, ola, ola.
Together as one.
Ola, ola, ola. African ways, African loving, African people, African youth, African kings and African queens.
Africa epe, Africa epon, Africa etusa. Everybody come together as one.
La patrie des dieux, bienvenue sur la terre mère. Le nord, le sud, embrasse l'est et l'ouest. On vit le rêve de Narnia.
Estamos en la tierra de nuestros abuelos.
Você sabe que as crianças são futuro, trazendo esperança para a próxima geração.
On docte pour l'Afrique de Djibouti au Sénégal. Comme bandit, tout ce que je fais, c'est soulever le Graal. L'Afrique est belle, l'Afrique est jeune, l'Afrique est forte. Enfant de la terre mère, lève le poing et envoie du love. Enfant de la terre mère, lève le poing et envoie du love.
So that just about wraps it up here for us on Amandla. Thank you so much for joining us again. Of course, we will be back next week, but in the meantime, please stay tuned for Jazz Euphoria.
Well, that's it, ladies and gentlemen, for Mandla this week. This has been a broadcast from a previous show, and we will be back to you when we come back from our travels in Malawi early in April. So with that, I'd ask Gwen to say...
Stay safe. Stay tuned for Jazz Euphorium.
Good night.
En présence de symptômes de la COVID-19, comme la toux, la fièvre, le mal de gorge, la perte du goût ou de l'odorat, isolez-vous et faites un test rapide à la maison. Pour en savoir plus et connaître les consignes d'isolement à respecter pour vous et ceux qui vivent avec vous selon votre résultat de test rapide, consultez québec.ca/isolement. On continue de se protéger. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.